I was awakened from a fitful sleep shortly after 2 o'clock in the morning by a shrill, sibilant, faceless voice.
That's Howard Beale, a fictitious newscaster who loses his mind on national television in the 1976 movie Network, becoming an unanticipated ratings king and prophet. Now, we'll get back to him in just a bit.
Is it safe to say that you are the Howard Beale of translated literature?
Okay.
You'll accept that role.
That's Chad Post. He's the publisher of Open Letter Books, a non-profit literary translation press, who received an email from a man named Oscar Van Gelderen and got mad as hell about it on his blog, 3%. Van Gelderen decided that Arnon Grunberg, an author he represented, wouldn't be published with Open Letter anymore.
So Arnon had gotten Oscar, who is a publisher in the Netherlands, and I believe Arnon's publisher, maybe at least a couple of his books, to be his agent. So Oscar is primarily a publisher, but then runs something called the Arnon Grunberg Agency.
Oscar wrote, "We know how Open Letter operates, and we can see the upside of that strategy, too." What do you think he meant by that? Is there some previous exchange that you had that alerted Oscar to your operation? What was the communications here?
No, there's really not. I mean, he's like, I've had some dealings with him in terms of he helped set up an event in Amsterdam for Arnon and for Tirza, and we sold like 150 copies of the book there, something astronomical, because Arnon's a really popular author in the Netherlands, probably not nearly as well known here in the U.S., unfortunately.
And there's the rub. Arnon Grunberg received reviews in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, but that relative success in the United States was lost in translation. Because as Post pointed out, Grunberg had 6 books published by 5 different American publishers over the course of 16 years. I asked Scott Esposito, critic and editor of the Quarterly Conversation, what he made of all this.
I don't think there's a huge perception that anyone's going to make a killing. And this might be a different case, because I think the author has pretty good sales in Europe, and obviously he's not in published with a variety of publishers here in the States, so there may be a sense of greater potential for those reasons, but I don't know, I've never really encountered the perception that, oh yeah, we're going to publish this author in the U.S. and it's going to be this huge sales thing.
It's sort of a disconnect between what international authors and publishers perhaps expect and hope for.
That's Michael Ordhofer.
And the reality on the ground in the United States.
He's the editor of The Complete Review and a fearless champion of translated literature.
Translation is basically supported by publishers like Open Letter. Basically the small independents who really have a translation focus, who are really dedicated to it. And the big houses, they don't pay that much attention to it. They'll grab some books, some big books, hoping for some bestsellers. You know, there are certain areas which obviously catch on, like the whole Nordic noir and crime fiction, but for real literature, you know, it's smaller publishers who are doing all the important work.
Hello there, Mr. Van Gelderen. My name is Edward Champion. I'm with the Bat Segundo Show, a radio program in New York. I was hoping to talk with you.
Oscar Van Gelderen didn't return my voicemails, my emails, my efforts to contact him through social media. And that's a pity, because if small publishers like Open Letter are being used to court bigger offers from larger publishers, then there's a developing ecosystem that may prove harmful to translated literature in the long run.
I don't expect you people to be capable of truth, but goddammit, at least you're capable of self-preservation.
Back to Howard Beale.
And I said, why me? Voice said, because you're on television, dummy.
At the time the Network was released in 1976, not everybody knew what to make of it. Many praised the acting, but some, like The New Yorker's Pauline Kael, decried writer Paddy Chayefsky's self-righteousness. Yet nearly 4 decades later, what seemed absurd has become the working model for pundits like Keith Olbermann and Bill O'Reilly, who were quite fond of fulminating to the television camera, sometimes with flying spittle. I met with journalist Dave Itzkoff, author of Mad as Hell, a book about the making of Network, in the New York Times building. I received a few suspicious looks. You see, when I talked with Mr. Itzkoff, there was one man who kept staring through the glass in shock. This was because someone had the funny idea of depositing Mr. Itzkoff and I in a conference room that was very close to the New York Times Book Review, a weekly publication that has been the recipient of a few of my brownies and tender demolition jobs over the years. Amazingly, neither Mr. Itzkoff and I felt compelled to shout during the conversation you are about to hear. But we did end up discussing the strange and naughty behavior of an Academy Award-winning actor, among other thoughtful topics. Okay, so I am here with Dave Itzkoff, who is most recently the author of Mad as Hell. Dave, you're not looking terribly indignant, but how are you doing?
I have nothing to be angry about yet.
Really?
But the day is young. I mean, it's only 11 a.m. It's a Tuesday.
How much rage do you typically go through in a 24-hour period?
Actually, it can be a lot. It really depends on my morning commute. You know, I take the subway. That is definitely a source of a lot of, ire and provocation, depending upon how crowded or empty my train is.
Yes, so. But for now, ensconced within the New York Times building, you are calm and sanguine.
Exactly, as the building tends to do to one, yes.
Yes, really, this building has a sort of outside power or a karma. You can levitate like the Pentagon, or the Pentagon like Abby Hoffman. Anyway.
It seems to have a calming influence, yes.
Okay. Well, let's get into Patty Chayefsky and Network, the film that this book, Mad as Hell, not the only book, as I have pointed out, there's another book here called Mad as Hell that also deals with Patty Chayefsky on the table.
That's right.
So, it's not just you. But anyway, Network was actually not Patty Chayefsky's first dramaturgical assault upon television. In 1955, and you did not note this in your book, Chayefsky wrote a script called The Man Who Beat Ed Sullivan. And this is about an Ohio TV host. He was going to match the length of a 3-hour talent show in this script that he wrote. You do mention The Imposters, which this pilot that Chayefsky wrote in 1969 about a fictional television executive who had the wry name of Eddie Grisham, which I thought was funny. Grisham. And it was not until Chayefsky started hanging out with Richard Wald and attending various television boardroom meetings that he came upon Network. I'm curious about this. I mean, he drew from his life experience for The Bachelor Party, for Marty. Is it safe to say that he needed experience for Network before he can actually really take on television in this indelible movie that we continue to quote and we continue to reference today?
Right. Well, in some ways the book is trying to make the point. I mean, I hate sort of stating the thesis so bluntly like this, but, his whole life's work, in a sense, is bound up in Network. And yes, I mean, it is nominally and very much a story about television and people who inhabit television, but it is also, it's a story about everything that ever upset him or irked him or bothered him in his life, and to some extent a story that he was rewriting not only in works that had to do or were set in the world of television, but if you look at some of the other early television plays, I mean, going all the way back to Marty, and even works that predate him or predate Marty, you will see there is a sort of recurring idea or a theme about, characters who have a kind of simmering rage, people who are unfulfilled or can't express themselves, and then are finally, often, but not always, given an opportunity to kind of cut loose or say what they really think, and it is explosive.
Yes.
And so that is an idea that he refines and revisits. It comes up not only in, obviously, his drama, but in his own life.
Yeah.
That he's somebody who often feels that the ideas that he is trying to communicate to his audience are not being received, or they're not getting them the way that he meant them, and that frustrates and annoys him, and that makes him an angry person. Not unfulfilled, but he often feels that he's falling short of whatever goal he set for himself. And so Network becomes the vehicle for all of this, compounded by a kind of, a feeling that media itself and a medium that he came up with, was at a real crossroads, that it was at something could potentially happen, at least in his lifetime or in the era that he was writing, something might happen that could send it in a very different direction, and that kind of corruption was representative of a lot of other things that were happening in life in that moment.
Based off of your research, is it safe to say that perhaps the cynicism that is attached to Network came from having to silently observe all of these boardroom meetings and these people moving things, moving money around, going ahead and gutting any kind of
credible programming, the kind of wonderful drama, the news that Chayefsky himself championed? Or?
I think that that was something that was even refined over time during the writing of the script. I mean, you reference a situation that happens in the book where he did visit both at NBC and CBS just to do research for a movie about television.
Yeah.
And he didn't know, when he met with Richard Wald, who was then the president of NBC News, he told Wald he didn't know yet whether he was going to write something that was maybe more a kind of day in the life piece. You know, that would have lots of moving parts and characters, almost in the way that The Hospital was, except just in a slightly different setting. Or maybe he would write something that was a little more satirical. And Wald says now he had a pretty strong sense that that's the direction Chayefsky was going to go in. But if you want to call it cynicism,
a refreshing cynicism, I would say. I watched the movie twice. I had to see it a second time, and I hadn't seen it in years, and it just bathed me in such a wonderful, exuberant cynicism. Maybe skepticism, perhaps, is the best, better term.
And it's fascinating. I mean, you can look at earlier incarnations of the script and see there were moments when it might have gone in more earnest directions. Yeah. I'm sure we'll get into some of the nitty gritty later.
Sure.
But characters who we now think of as being, really, characters who, have mean streaks or really were, just going for it all, they could have been much nicer people. It could have had a happier ending. Something about him told Chayefsky that this was not really how life worked.
Yeah. Well, this leads me to wonder, why did they let this guy, who dressed in sweatpants, into the television boardroom? You would think that, here's a guy who has been very angry in his writing, who has championed the common man, and yet he was able to get this incredible access even surveying these meetings. I mean, was it just a matter of nobody had really tackled television to this extent before? But surely they had to know the guy was going to do something.
I think it was a confluence of factors, and one is that Chayefsky still had this tremendous esteem in the entertainment industry, not only going back to the TV writing, but at that time he was a two-time Academy Award writing screenwriter. He'd won the Academy Award for the screenplay of Marty. He'd won it for The Hospital. So, here was a guy, this was not just, he may have looked like a bum off the street, but he had more of a reputation than that.
Yeah.
And also because in his NBC and CBS, they vouched for him. Cronkite, who knew him through Sidney Lumet, would have vouched for him, surely. But they didn't know. He didn't know what he was going to write. They didn't know what he was going to write. And I think certainly in that era, it was unthinkable that somebody would write something about something as, unassailable and perfect as television.
Yes.
What an infallible medium. Who would dare think that we're doing anything wrong with it?
Yeah.
So it was a little bit, it wasn't even something I think that they would have considered.
Is it because Chayefsky had such a very esteemed attachment to his television plays, they thought that he wouldn't actually torch the medium? Maybe something like that was in the mind?
I think also it had to do with just, how these things work where it's sort of a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
He didn't know the news people directly, but he would get, somebody in the entertainment division would vouch for him and say, hey, he's a good guy, he's just going to sit for a little while. Also, as you see from the meetings with Wald, until he was sort of drawn out and asked explicitly, well, what are you writing? He, in his research, he seemed to be pretty silent and pretty opaque. And so I don't think anybody, if somebody's just sort of sitting in the corner of a room and taking notes, maybe you think that he's, from an outside consulting company and he's here to, assess who can be laid off. And
corporate efficiency expert.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is actually a pretty good idea for the next generation of Chayefskys. Let's discuss this incredible power that Chayefsky had, this extraordinary power that he had in terms of creative control. Paddy Chayefsky worked the system amazingly. I'm going to bring up the Sean Considine biography, Mad as Hell.
Yeah, please do.
It points out that Chayefsky exploited a clause on his contract for The Bachelor Party that read, while working on the script for The Bachelor Party, the proprietor, the writer, must have accommodations commensurate with his New York residence. So he was not actually schlepped into this terrible room. He lived in this extraordinary affluence while working on that picture. In an endnote to your book, the deal for the network screenplay paid out Chayefsky in 6 installments of $50,000 each. So the question I have is, how could Paddy Chayefsky get the kind of unprecedented creative control that he did? Was it his business acumen, his charisma? What was it about it? And why couldn't he stand up to Ken Russell in Altered States?
Well, we can deal with the Russell issue in a,
sure.
in a little bit.
Sure.
But I think it was twofold. I mean, I think one is, you know, he'd had so many repeated experiences, and this goes all the way back to, you know, again, his work in television, you know, just writing the one act, or sorry, the 1 hour dramas, that even then he was so frustrated with the idea that somebody else could either, you know, overrule him or make decisions that he didn't approve of. And, you know, if you read the introduction to his book of teleplays that he published in 1955, he starts off sort of talking about, you know, how much affection he has for the medium of television. He wants to stay in it for his whole career. And then it basically turns into a sort of diatribe about how little authority he actually has over his own works and how, you know, frustrating that is. So that is something that he always sought out. He had other experiences going forward, you know, in his early, you know, film screenwriting career, his theater career, where he saw what he thought were, you know, situations where he lost control and that disappointed or frustrated him. And as he moved forward in each successive project, only took on work, only sought work and demanded in all his work that he have that ultimate authority. If you didn't give it to him, all he had to do was walk away. And he did that repeatedly. He did walk away from projects. Things would get very far along. There would be, you know, contracts signed, you know, pilot scripts written. And if he still didn't get what he wanted, he would drop it.
Yeah. Well, then in that case, why didn't he anticipate Ken Russell pushing him off the set of Altered States? That is the end of Chayofsky's control. And the fact that it's someone like Ken Russell is also phenomenal, too, because at that point in his career, he was kind of on the decline.
Yes. Well, there were you know, extenuating and specific circumstances to Altered States that they had already lost one director on that film. They had already pushed out Arthur Penn, who was probably overwhelmed by just the need for the special effects and the technology, which was, of course, much more limited in that era than you could do now. He was sort of out of his league in that sense. So they'd already fired one director, and he was very insistent on Russell being deposed also. But because they had already crossed that Rubicon once, if they fired even a second director, it would not only be tremendously harmful to the project, but they had nobody else lined up to succeed Russell. His longtime producer, Howard Gottfried, told me the story of how he offered to Chayefsky, the only person who could probably direct this if we fire Ken Russell is you yourself.
Yes.
And for as much as, you know, as certain as Chayefsky was that he knew what was right for everything at every time, he did not have that kind of confidence in himself as a director and knew that that was never going to happen. And he had to essentially, you know, bite the bullet.
Sean Considine, he also observed that Chayofsky's scripts, especially during his television days, were so meticulous and so heavily polished that nobody really needed to touch them. And I was wondering, because you went through the Paddy Chayofsky papers at the Performing Arts Library, if you were able to determine, well, who did he turn to help edit his work? Who did he turn to get that sense of, okay, you're actually doing okay here? Or was he just that good and that intransigent of a self-editor?
You know, I think, intransigence probably does have something to do with it. But, I mean, his writing process, even before he delivered it to anybody else, let's say other than his wife, who I think is probably the first person to read a complete, you know, copy of the network screenplay, it was so internalized, but it went through so many refinements and revisions. And he, certainly by the time he gets to writing Network, I mean, he's really worked up a system where, you know, he's writing not only drafts of what we would know as a screenplay, but almost writing these kind of novelized treatments where he's essentially writing a whole book, you know, describing exactly the movie that he sees in his head, but writing it in straight prose.
Yeah.
And then rewriting it. And, you know, he would write almost a whole manuscript and then just start over again. And you know, there are notes to himself sometimes. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, crossing out, rewriting. But sometimes it almost feels like he just is sort of seeing, how much do I even remember from this first or previous draft that I want to carry forward? And in Network, you know, in the notes that he left behind, I mean, there was also a lot of self-flagellation, and that he seems...
Self-flagellation, how so?
Well, that he seems like he feels like he's sort of onto something, but he also has no idea what he's trying to say, and he's really sort of beating himself up about it. That he, at a certain point in early in the process, he writes this note to himself where he sort of realizes, I've got all these characters and I have no idea really what I'm trying to say with them. I know that Howard Beale is really important. I've got to give him a kind of climactic speech, but what would I even have him say? Who am I rooting for?
Yeah.
And but this is all, you know, self-directed and within him. This is not in any way soliciting anybody else's input or notes or edits. That doesn't happen until he basically delivers the screenplay to a studio that's going to produce it. And then, you know, they almost came to a deal with Columbia. That fell through. I'm not aware that there are any actual, you know, there would have been somebody internally at Columbia that would have said it would have evaluated it, but I'm not sure that there are specific notes on the script. He does get some notes from MGM and United Artists when he delivers it there. He incorporates some of those notes, doesn't incorporate others. So even there, he's got a lot of latitude to, again,
to resist studio notes.
Yes, and to still write it the way that he envisions it.
So let me get this straight. I mean, all writers go through this self-recrimination process. And in this case, it seems to me that Chayefsky was basically sending notes to himself, perhaps on network and other scripts, to ensure that, you know, he would have the kind of, I guess, inner editor. I mean, that he actually had to go ahead and reprimand himself, and out of these self-flagellations, as you call them, this is what led to the polish that that Considine and others have identified.
I would agree, and you know, not all the notes to himself necessarily take a tone that's sort of as severe as the one that I described. That letter to himself, I thought was just particularly telling, because you think of him as a writer with just so much talent and so much capability. You think, well, you know, did he ever have a moment of self-doubt? So to see it sort of spelled out that clearly, I thought was stunning. But sometimes the notes were just more, workmanlike, or yeah, it was more sort of straightforward in the sense of, you know, should I add a love story? How should it play out? Even the sort of the ending of the movie, which, the ending itself is, the ending that he went with is not necessarily the most happy or upbeat, but he certainly contemplated much darker scenarios. Yeah. And kind of reeled himself in a little bit. And it's just, I have to believe, and you know, maybe I'm naive, but I feel like a lot of movies that we see today, there was a draft was written, there was a rewrite, and then they shot the movie.
Yeah.
And Chayefsky did not work that way. I mean, yeah, there was revision and revision and revision well before he even, you know, as I said, shared it with anybody or delivered something. There was a lot of reworking that took place.
With the exception of the one-hour Marty, where he delivers the third act at the last possible minute, he doesn't actually know how it's going to end, but manages to get it in the nick of time. So
I think with television, and certainly in that era of television, things were, you know, it was a little bit different. I mean, he certainly felt like those teleplays were very dispensable. There was a lot of just sort of, you know, shoveling just to fill airtime, and
yeah,
that's what made it such a sort of boundless medium, but also I think for him a very frustrating one.
I also think it's important to get into the fact that Patty was there for the casting process. He was there on the set during all of these productions, which is extraordinary. And let's talk about this particular idea. I mean, we had mentioned Ken Russell before, and I'll get back to the directorial relationship he had with Russell and with Sidney Lumet. But there was a Patty light that was on the set, because Patty actually stood there and observed every single performance. Initially, during the early part of shooting of Network, he was standing directly in the key light, looking into the actor. So the actor is, you know, basically pouring her guts out, and here is Patty's face looking at her intensely, which is extraordinary. And so they had to devise the Patty light to actually go ahead and take care of that. This leads me to wonder, well, first off, was it kind of an actor-friendly set that allowed Patty to be pushed to the back, or was he always offering that intense stare, even in the other films that he worked on?
Well, you know, at least in the case of Network, I mean, all the actors certainly, with one notable exception, I mean, they all felt like they were given lots of latitude to do what they want. I mean, there was a two-week rehearsal process that preceded even the filming, which, you know, that was Lumet's institution, that they have a rehearsal process. So I think that gave them a lot of comfort. Lumet certainly was known as an actor's director, so they knew they were in capable hands. But yes, it was certainly a very unusual facet that the writer was going to be there to that degree. Chayefsky also was rarely I mean, he was not giving direction to the actors. And even if he noticed that an actor performed a line incorrectly or different than he had written it in the script, what he would tend to do is tell the script supervisor. He would say to her, you know, this person got the line wrong or they didn't get it exactly as I wrote it. You tell them that this is the line. So even in that way, there was a little bit of indirection. He wasn't confrontational in that way, but he just made sure that up to that point that they had gotten all the right people who would essentially follow the instructions once they were on set.
Since you brought up the script supervisor, Faye Weldon, I want to know how you got access to her diary.
You know, in that case, it was simply just a matter of, you're talking about Kay Chapin, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Kay Chapin. Yes, my apologies.
No, not at all. That was just a matter of, you know, reaching out to as many people as I could find who were still alive and were involved with the film. And it was just one of those quirks of happenstance that Network was, if I remember this correctly now, either the very first or maybe the second Hollywood movie that she ever worked on.
Uh-huh.
And she was so sort of starstruck by the people who were in the film and thought, oh, this is such a high-powered A-list cast. I should keep a diary just for myself. And
yes.
I really lucked out in that case.
Well, when did you do to get the diary in your hands?
She volunteered that.
Really?
I was literally just calling around to people who, as I said, were still alive, involved with the film. The one, I think, consistent through line in almost every person that I spoke to is that they were just so proud to have worked on this film. And
yeah.
They still had, for whatever they might have gone through during the making of it, they still had very positive associations with the film, were happy to be remembered for working on it. So if they had resources that they could share, oftentimes they were very willing to do so.
Calling around, I mean, this leads me to wonder, where did you start in this? Did you start through the Patty Chayofsky papers, or did you start calling people around trying to get stories? And what did you do to sift through the
Sure. Sure. So you may notice this actually began as an article that I wrote for the New York Times.
Yes, I did notice that.
And so in 2011, sadly, this was just before Lumette passed away, that the library approached me and just said, you know, would you like to take a look at some of the papers, the Chayofsky papers that we have on Network? And they even to sort of entice me, they emailed some of the documents I already described to you, drafts of letters of apology that Chayefsky wrote to Walter Cronkite and John Chancellor.
Yes.
So I had a sense there was already something there. Once we committed to doing the book, I spent probably about 4 or 5 months just working the papers, just looking at what the library had, just looking at, you know, doing background research on all the principals. So that included Chayefsky, Lumette, Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Peter Finch, and then looking through as many of the papers that specifically related to Network and the sort of the years surrounding its creation. I was done with that research at the end of 2011, I want to say.
Yeah.
And then I spent the start of 2012 making the phone calls and just reaching out to every single person that I could think of. And people were still close to each other or still crossed paths with each other. So I would find one person. They would say, hey, you should try this other person. That person would point me to a third person. Finding Howard Gottfried, who was Patty Chayefsky's producer on Network as well as on The Hospital, was, tremendously, singularly important because, you know, he was Chayefsky's closest confidant on this project and, you know, probably had, you know, as many telling details as there were in Chayefsky's papers, he certainly had as many in his own mind.
What about Faye Dunaway? I mean, she was the most difficult person on the set, and I presume that you made attempts to get her on the record. Did you talk with her, meet with her, talk to any of her people or anything like that?
I will say, I mean, we tried just about every sort of reasonable avenue that we could to get her to participate, and that is
even through New York Housing Court.
I will say that we went through all the sort of traditional channels of, you know, agents and representatives that she still possesses. I was pointed to a lot of people who still know her, you know, in the industry, people who are friendly with her, people who say, you know, I did ask her about this, and she just wasn't interested, and that's her right. I think that's part of the Dunaway mystique that she's not accessible.
Yeah, but I mean, you're a charming young man. I'm sure you could have actually persuaded her to talk. This is her time to finally correct some of the impressions that have sprung up, especially during that the love scene with William Holden. I mean, you know, when you say she wasn't interested, I mean, did you hear from her directly, or did you hear from?
I never got a direct answer from her. I did hear from some of these other people who did have, you know, direct access, and the answer was always she's just not interested. Even people who were very generous to me, who were going well out of their way to even approach her about this, and they were always polite in getting back to me, but I don't. The answer was clear that she did not want to participate. She wrote a memoir of her own in the 90s, and perhaps she felt that she said everything she needed to say in that.
So here's the question: who was the hardest person to persuade to go on the record about this?
Other than the people who just did not participate at all, I don't think anybody was particularly difficult. As I said, I mean, everyone is proud to have the continuing association with the film. It was sometimes it was just a matter of, you know, tracking the people down. I mean, finding Peter Finch's daughter that took a little bit of doing, but no more so than, you know, the kinds of things I would do for reporting an article. I mean, we have certainly, being at the Times, you have access to a Nexus database and other kinds of research tools. So once people understood what the project was, again, certainly having the previous Times story to sort of say, well, here's, you know, you can at least get a sense of my relationship to the film. You know, this is not going to be a sort of hatchet piece on the movie, and why would somebody even bother with something like that? I think people were, you know, pretty open to it.
Yes. So let's get back to how Chayefsky worked with his various directors. He started off obviously with Delbert Mann for the films, and Sidney Lumet later, of course, for Network. And then with Ken Russell, it kind of all went to hell in a handbasket. Do you think that in order for Chayefsky to maintain this magnanimous creative control, that he needed to have like an actor's director, someone who could actually who was not so visually flamboyant as Russell, or was it just Altered States was just a very strange Chayefsky script?
Well, Russell, I think that was sort of the worst possible combination of personalities there. I mean, two
extraordinary exuberant. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes. I mean, two people who could not, you know, both of them wanted things to be exactly the way they wanted it. Were not in any way compatible with each other. Obviously, just a very bad scenario there. Lumet, I think, in some ways was the perfect combination, because there was somebody who I think was just exceedingly generous and also knew what he was getting into. And there is a sense, you know, in the book, you know, speaking to some of the people who were close to Lumet at the time, like his production director, Philip Rosenberg, there was a sense that Lumet had to think this over a little bit for himself, because he kind of knew what he was getting into and what in some ways he was giving up, that he was not, he was going to have a lot of authority over this, but he was not going to have necessarily the final control. But then again, it doesn't sound like there were very many conflicts between him and Chayefsky, and at least Lumet figured out how to accommodate him enough that he felt like he was getting the kind of input that he wanted. And they did have, as you talked about earlier, that sort of strange setup of the Patty light, so everybody knew exactly where to find him, and he could stand in a place where he wouldn't interfere with a shot and feel like he had basically, you know, direct eyes on everything that was going on.
Yeah.
That was enough to placate him.
Yeah, either or a paddy wagon.
Right, right, that was next. Yeah. If the light didn't work, he was into the paddy wagon.
Yes. I wanted to go back to Dunaway and Lumet.
Sure.
You have this extraordinary story in which Lumet gives Faye Dunaway this ultimatum on Diana. Lumet says, "Diana has no vulnerability. And if you actually include any vulnerability, I will cut this out." So based off of that, you want the role, and she was begging to have it and so forth. I'm wondering, how do you think Lumet was able to maintain this ultimatum through the course of the production, especially because Faye Dunaway became more difficult as it went on? And in light of the fact that you couldn't actually get Faye Dunaway, what did you do to try to get her side of the story here to be fair to all parties?
Sure. Well, there were, Lumet tells that story in his own memoir, so that sounds reasonably authoritative. And also, you know, Dunaway tells a slightly different version of that story in her memoir. Her memories are more about already having, you know, her own casting suggestions for who should play the other characters around her in the movie. I think there had to be, on some level, she had to be impressed, first of all, that, you know, this was a Chayefsky script, so that meant something. Lumet was directing it. That that also, you know, carried a certain weight. She was, at that stage, the only actress or actor that had been signed, committed to the project. So she knew to a certain degree things were going to be built around her, or that, you know, that that already, you know, gave it a certain gravity in her direction. But she did also consult with other people who were close to her about, you know, is this going to be a controversial role? And that's documented too. I mean, other people have, you know, their own remembrances of discussing this with her. And others even tried to sort of talk her out of it, that they thought it was going to be sort of too polarizing, too unlikable. And it sounds like that was something that actually appealed to Dunaway, that this was – certainly this was a moment in the culture where just the role of women in the workplace was still being debated. It certainly, you know, in the book I talk about, you know, the experience that Barbara Walters is having in the news media at this very moment while the story of Diane is playing out on the screen.
Getting a lot of shit for having a $1 million paycheck.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, hardly an easy place for a woman to be working at the time. And I think Dunaway liked it, that this was not your sort of run-of-the-mill female character. And if anything, she was presented as tough, if not tougher, than the men that she worked alongside. And that clearly appealed to her.
You also mentioned this story about Ned Beatty getting the role by lying like a snake. And it leads me to ask about how Lumet and Chayofsky did the casting for this. Were they looking for personality qualities in their actor more than acting chops, would you say? Or how did this factor
in? Well, I mean, the Beatty is sort of a unique case because he was recruited at a time when...
Last minute, yeah.
Yes, the filming had already begun. So they were, you know, he had a little bit more room to negotiate. If he walked away, they were in deep, deep trouble.
Yeah.
But they did, you know, before filming commenced, I mean, they were trying to find names, you know, A-list people, really, to play all the principal roles. So that's, you know, the characters that did eventually go to Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Peter Finch, those characters, you know, certainly to try to find Howard Beale. You know, Chayefsky wrote directly to Paul Newman. They sought out George C. Scott directly, who had starred in The Hospital.
Yeah.
None of those, for various reasons, none of those things panned out. They were even thinking about people like, you know, would Jimmy Stewart do it? Would Walter Matthau do it? It probably...
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
And everybody shot them down, which is, you know, in a sense how they finally do get to Peter Finch, that here's somebody who was genuinely interested in the role.
Yeah.
For a lot of the sort of supporting characters, the people who, let's say, only have, you know, passing screen time, a few minutes here, a few minutes there, that's where they sort of, you know, just work more kind of strategically. Like, let's look at people who are better known for their stage acting. Let's look at people who just look the part and come into our auditions with a certain energy. And they were just so anxious to get going that some people were snapped up just kind of, you know, on the basis of a single audition.
The other thing that's fascinating about Network is how the New York locations were very hard to find, including that boardroom scene with Ned Beatty, which is at the New York Public Library, which involved a lot of serious rigging restrictions, which made it a pain in the ass for them to actually set up the lights and all that. But also, you mentioned that all of the scenes of where everyone is shouting, "I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore," into the streets, were shot in abandoned buildings, and all of these crews had to walk up these stairs with the lights and all that. I mean, which is extraordinary. And also, not to mention, the UBS interior was actually in Toronto, and that stairwell was in two different cities. So the question is, you know, why was it so difficult to shoot in New York? And second, why do they insist, given the limitations of shooting this and setting this in New York? Because it seems like it was extraordinarily difficult to find anything. And also with that Ned Beatty boardroom story, I've missed one key part of it, and that is, you know, that they actually were going to shoot that in the New York Stock Exchange, and then all of a sudden, wait, there's a speech about DuPont, AT&T, and all this. So let's talk. Why is it so difficult?
Sure. Well, just to sort of, I'll address the fifth point first.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Sure.
Well, so the idea.
I'm glad you can keep track.
No. Hopefully, I'll get. I think I've. Yes. I mean, you know, the reason why they wanted to be in New York is because that's where Lumet and Chayefsky were most comfortable. Lumet, by that point, certainly making all of his movies in New York. Chayefsky doing his writing and living in New York, that's where they were – that's their base of operation. So that was sort of first principles. We're going to do this in New York. We'll figure out everything else. We'll follow. We'll emanate from that. But the immediate difficulty that they run into is that they need a functioning, practical television studio to do all those live TV scenes. And even though there are many studios in New York that theoretically could have accommodated them, there's no chance that once people are actually able to see the script or at least see the pages that take place in the studio, there's nobody that wants to let them in and use the studios. There's also an issue of just cost, that because you know you're talking about two separate unions that would have had to sort of oversee that. If you have basically TV movie filming on top of TV filming, you would have had to pay for TV unions and movie unions, and that could have made it extremely expensive.
Yeah.
So that's why they, at least for all of this, all the scenes that you see that are taking place in a TV studio, that's all happening in Toronto, where they didn't face any of those issues.
Yeah.
And as you bring up with the Ned Beatty scene, that's another direct example where, yes, they could have potentially could have done it in the New York Stock Exchange until the Stock Exchange was shown the script and said, here's the scene that's going to take place. And they were basically like, no way. We're not, you know, we're not going to have a scene where Ned Beatty is basically, you know, talking about this kind of, aggressive, almost warlike version of capitalism where, you know, there are no nations. There's only AT&T and ITT and Union Carbide. They're definitely not going to allow.
But at one point they did allow it.
Until they knew what the scene was going to contain.
Yeah.
They liked the idea of it being a Chayefsky movie until they really had a sense of the content. But in some ways, I'm as guilty as anybody of sort of romanticizing the real sort of nadir that New York was at in the 1970s.
Yes. But aren't we all, you know?
Right. But it does facilitate moments like the Mad as Hell scene, where it does, because there are all these either abandoned or underutilized buildings with all these free apartments that they can go into, they are able to basically set up these entire street scenes of people leaning out of their windows or going out into fire escapes and shouting it out.
Let's talk about the Mad as Hell speech. Peter Finch was only able to get through the whole speech one time. There were two takes. And in the second take, Finch stops 1 minute and 10 seconds into it. It seems utterly insane in hindsight, given the difficulty of Chayefsky's language and given the emotional intensity it takes to deliver that speech, that was actually even in there and that was actually even considered to be filmed. So the question is, how did this happen? Was Lumet just a munificent guy because he was a former actor and he knew that, you know, I'm not going to get more than two takes? What was the preparation Finch brought to that?
Sure. Well, it is a confluence of a lot of, strange and unique factors, one of which is Lumet just wanting to work as rapidly as possible. And if you go through the entire shooting script of the movie, you will see that there are a few scenes that I think the most takes he allows of any scene at all is maybe 9 takes. And that's one portion of Beatrice Straight's monologue to William Holden, where she's confronting him over his affair with Faye Dunaway. And most likely it's just because she probably stumbled over some of the words and had to keep doing it again. But Lumet was very much the kind of guy who, you know, if he saw it in front of him, if he just saw you acting out the scene and he believed that it had been captured in that first take or in that second take, sometimes he wouldn't even shoot an additional take for, you know, for safety or for coverage. Yeah. It was just, I saw it, I believed it, let's move on.
Like Woody Van Dyke, you know? Yeah.
Right. So there's already that aspect to him, and they did have the opportunity to rehearse these scenes, so he already kind of knows a little bit what he's going to get from the actors. Also, funny enough, the very, very first day of filming, any filming that took place on network, among the things that they shot were, if you actually watch how the Mad as Hell scene is edited, there are some portions where you're watching Peter Finch live in studio. There are other portions where you're watching him on people's television sets.
Yeah.
That had to be recorded first on video. And some of that video was shot literally on the very first day of filming the movie. So that was one of the very first scenes that Finch was ever even called upon to do was the Mad as Hell speech. And if you watch him in those video, you know, the portions of the video edit, there are almost a little bit more restrained than how he delivers the speech when he's on film, you know, in the studio, and you're sort of watching him as he's delivering it.
But I'm wondering if Lumet directed all of his movies that way, because you have a lot of locations, you have a very fast shoot, you're going to want to get as few takes as possible because you need to keep the operation going. Was that a consideration in terms of this?
I don't know that he specifically was trying to get things done. I mean, he just had, you know, it wasn't that he was trying to sort of beat the clock. They did actually finish Network early,
yes,
and under budget. But you know, I'm trying to remember the phrasing of this correctly. I think this is a sort of apocryphal tale. One of his actors on And Justice for All tells him, I think I can get that scene in less than one take. That might have been, you know, one of his actors told, because that was his reputation.
Yeah.
He really just didn't feel that multiple takes were necessary.
And now you've got me thinking about Pacino going, you're out of order!
It might have been Jeffrey Tambor who said that to
Lumet. See Jeffrey Tambor saying that. I have a query about this extraordinary claim involving Robert Duvall. He enjoyed antagonizing people from the window by flashing his ass out and shouting at them. I looked in the end notes, and you note that your source for this is anonymous. So, you know, you have only one source for the anecdote here. What steps did you do to work with Mr. Duvall and corroborate this? Because this is an extraordinary anecdote, or is this just merely an anecdote?
No. Duvall was the only other person who, you know, didn't sort of play ball with us in terms of our attempts to, you know, participate in
really?
The book. But if
perhaps he knew people were blabbing to you.
I don't know that he'd be this embarrassed by the anecdote, because if you do your, you don't have to do that much homework on him to find that. He does have a track record of these kinds of stunts on other films.
Yeah.
He doesn't necessarily mind dropping trow just to sort of get rises out of people. I don't know if that's something that's continued even to the modern day, but it is something that, it
was in place in the 70s.
It wasn't only on this film that he is reputed to have done so.
Reputed.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, beside from the mysterious actor, did you have any other source on this? Or?
That was one person's observation. But again, as I said, because this is something that, if this was completely out of line with anything that I'd ever heard or read about Duvall, then no, I would not have used it. And there, you know, I'm obviously not going to get into specifics, but at times, people in the course of reporting anything, people will tell you things. If there isn't corroboration on things that are sensitive or that could be disputed or could be matters of interpretation, you know, if you don't get that corroboration, of course, you don't want to use that material.
But would you say that because he has done it a second time on another film or on several films, that is, in your mind, as reliable as having a second source?
I think that it is certainly within his character. It does not seem that unthinkable that could have happened on this film.
Character is enough to serve as a second source?
In a situation like this, in something that benign, I think so.
Okay. Well, let's go on to Faye Dunaway and William Holden in this love scene, which was controversial for two reasons. One, Holden didn't actually enjoy shooting sex scenes. That was news to me. And two, the framing of Dunaway is problematic because the camera is so tight that if the framing is off by the projectionist, then you actually get to see it. And in fact, there was a UK airing of this, and unfortunately, it was seen. So, you know, I'm wondering about this. What negotiations occurred to actually make this happen, and how did this continue to stay controversial for many years if Faye Dunaway knew about the framing problem?
Sure. Well, this is something that crops up. Certainly, by the time she signs on to the movie, she knows that there's going to be this very famous love scene between her and Holden. Not famous because, you know, there's any skin shown, but because over the course of this evening out with Holden's character, from the moment they're having dinner to, you know, running back to the motel room to, you know, getting naked and getting it on, and even in a sort of, you know, a moment of, post-coital relaxation, she is talking about nothing but TV ratings and her ambitions and what she foresees for the TV schedule. And so it is this running commentary on the cynicism of this particular character and her, endless ambition. So that is, at least in the mind of Chayefsky, the necessity of the scene, that she has to sort of go all the way because, you know, in order for the joke or the commentary to work. Now, once they come back from filming the portions in Toronto, the studio portions, they're back in New York now, that's when she sort of That's when she makes her ultimatum that she's not going to participate in a love scene. She's not going to show any skin. And this is actually something that, you know, certainly she has other movies in her on her resume by this point, things that she's done, whether it's Bonnie and Clyde, the Thomas Crown Affair, where you've seen her, and certainly in Chinatown, you've seen her sort of partially reveal herself in other ways. So this comes as a total shock to everybody on the film that there was no realization that this is something that she would not want to do, and there's a lot of back channel negotiation between Howard Gottfried and Faye Dunaway's agent. Her lawyer makes an appearance on the set. Finally, it's codified in basically a handwritten agreement between Howard Gottfried and Faye Dunaway. Maybe his portion was typewritten and hers is handwritten, that he very clearly specifies how the love scene is going to be orchestrated. What she's not going to have to show her breasts or nipples or any portion of the pubic region. I believe she will have to simulate an orgasm, but that's that. And then she not only signs this, but there's almost this kind of Bush-like signing statement at the bottom.
Bush-like, huh?
In George W. Bush-like, where she not only, she's sort of reserving the right. She said, "It is my understanding that Sidney Lumet will consult with me, and I will have approval over all, camera angles." And Lumet, and he also lays out very clearly to her exactly how he's going to frame it and what's going to take place.
Yeah.
And then it's shot, in a closed set, on a soundstage. It's one of the few portions of the film where they actually used a soundstage instead of a practical location to do this. Very few people are allowed to even observe this taking place. Then she gets to see how it's edited, and the editing becomes its whole separate issue, because in the editing she can see that her nipples are visible for a few frames, and she clearly, by the account of several people who were there, she definitely was upset by that. And you can make the argument that that's not something that she agreed to.
Yeah.
But she is at least placated. She's told that that's a quirk of, how we're projecting this film back to you in this room. It's not necessarily representative of the final film.
Sure. You managed to get, to my great surprise, near the end of the book, quotes from Bill O'Reilly and Keith Olbermann. And in the acknowledgments, you point out that Olbermann had a particular... he was particularly excited about this movie. And this leads me to wonder, first, how you got these two. And second, Olbermann, was he just... he was between jobs. Did he need a friend? What happened there?
Olbermann was so generous. It was kind of any of these broadcasters to participate in a project like this. And I think it speaks. It's got nothing to do with me whatsoever. It's all about if you're working in broadcasting now and you came up in the 70s, 80s, even in the 90s, you definitely crossed paths with Network. It was a movie that in some way was commenting on your business, and there's a lot of respect and esteem for it in the sense that it did correctly anticipate what was going to happen in the TV news business. And so, a lot of prominent broadcasters at the very least have opinions about it, if not, as in Olbermann's case, adore and still worship the film, even as they continue to work in the industry that it's criticizing.
Yeah, yeah.
Olbermann, I think, as I say in the acknowledgments, I think he's got the script memorized. He just knows it in and out. He probably could have written a better book than I did. O'Reilly, I think, I don't know if he has quite the same esteem for it, but I will say that he does now have a recurring segment on the O'Reilly Factor called Mad as Hell, where they invite viewers to write in about day-to-day issues that they're annoyed about.
Why did he want to talk with you? Did you meet in person or was on the phone?
In O'Reilly's case, we spoke by phone, but it was just a situation.
So he couldn't point fingers or anything.
I wouldn't have minded. I'd still love the opportunity for some face-to-face conversation. But at minimum, he definitely is aware of people who think that the Howard Beale character is in some way an anticipation or a forecast of the kind of broadcaster that he is.
He's very aware of his place in relation to Howard Beale.
Yeah, and I think he also makes a reasonably, I don't know if I'm totally convinced by his argument, but he also, in the book, you'll see he talks about Network as being a commentary as much on the audience, the kind of people who were consuming this stuff, and, just the sense that they will go in any direction that television takes them, and there's a lot of truth to that, too.
There's one fascinating, since we were talking about particular clauses Don't worry, I'll get you out of here.
No, no, just sorry.
Yeah.
So, just got to keep an eye on the clock.
No, that's cool. So when Network was first aired on network television, you note that CBS executives had once contemplated the idea of replacing bullshit with bull soup. I don't know about you, but I'm fascinated by the words that are put in replacement of the actual language. Yet three of Chayefsky's 13 bullshits were permitted when the movie aired on TV. You quote Don O'Brien, CBS's vice president of program practices, saying, "BS is not obscene. It's gutter slang and can mean many things." So with this viewpoint, and based on your meticulous research, what was the common bullshit quality among television networks? Did you uncover any bullshit methodology? Was Chayefsky, by way of his reputation, allowed more bullshit than the norm? I'm curious.
No, this was an extraordinary and singular circumstance that they were going to allow these rare instances of obscenity in, you know, a network TV broadcast of a studio Hollywood movie, and that they, you know, it certainly speaks to, you know, the reputation of this particular film. There's a little bit, I'm sure, of a titillation also that the network, you know, they're sort of getting out in front of this and sort of inviting people to tune in, if for nothing else than the opportunity to hear, you know, swear words on TV in a primetime hour. But that also that they, you know, they are recognizing that this, you know, this is an acceptable or a permissible, you know, use of the word, or at least in a way that it's not going to inflame, you know, so many people that they, you know, could get in trouble for it.
So based off of this, I mean, you know, obviously when Aaron Sorkin accepted his Oscar, he said it's nice to be up here having this network in the actual screenplay for Social Network. Is there anybody really today that could be on that level of Paddy Chayefsky? I mean, do we actually have to look to Aaron Sorkin as the guy who is closest to that, or...
Well, I mean, I think Sorkin was tremendously influenced, you know, by Chayefsky. I think there are a lot of authors who have, you know, strong social messages in their work and are using media to comment on media. But certainly the sort of confluence of all those factors plus a real sort of, you know, a sense of rage and righteousness, that's a little harder to find, you know? I mean, maybe you could make the case that, you know, Oliver Stone's movies from the, you know, let's say the late 70s to early 90s had a lot of those qualities. I think, and I think even a recent movie like Argo has, you know, maybe three of the five things that I just mentioned. Movies like Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle in their own ways, if you could put Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle together, maybe you'd get a movie like Network. But in terms of a contemporary feature film released by a studio having all those facets, I don't think it's there.
But would you say that Righteous Indignation is a tougher sell in 2014 than it was in 1976?
Well, I think there even being a screenwriter who feels that strongly or passionately about anything is capable of channeling that into an articulate screenplay, has the track record or reputation where they could get that made. I think that's already that Venn diagram doesn't intersect anywhere. And you know, what topics could infuriate people to, you know, to that degree that they'd even want to make a mass movie about it?
Where do you start? Income inequality, drones, the NSA. Anyway,
sure. But those are all topics that could at least sort of spawn a narrative idea, and then it's a question of, you know, do you feel that passionately about it, and can you think of a narrative context to present it in that doesn't feel, you know, didactic, something that actually sort of dramatizes a story. And remember that, you know, I mean, Chayefsky is not just commenting on, you know, the badness of TV or of media, but he's talking about, you know, every single thing that he feels in his lifetime, and that also has to do with, you know, paranoia about the situation in the Middle East, or, you know, fear of, you know, the corporatization of America, corporations having more power, you know, than elected officials or even than the media itself. I mean, it's everything that you could even be the slightest bit worried about in the year 1976, he's worried about it. And every single one of those things turns up in that movie in some way. So, you know, if you're the screenwriter that wants to follow him, you've got to find the vehicle for every single one of the fears that you just alluded to.
Okay. Okay. Well, Dave Itzkoff, I have to return you to the New York Times building, but thank you very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, thank you so much for allowing me to do this. I really appreciate it.
Great. Fantastic. On the side of the road, the night it had frozen through my little bones. So you took me in your arms, you squeezed out the cold.